your mic's on. Sorry? Oh, no, you have to. It's all them using it at that end. Oh, not for me. Oh, anyway. Shall we get going? Good evening, everybody. Can you all hear me? Yeah? Mic is on. Okay. My name is Eva Soboda. I'm the Deputy Director of International Law and Policy at the ICRC, and I'm delighted to welcome you and the guest speakers. Just a technical glitch. Unfortunately, Jawad is not online. We couldn't manage technically, so we've got, instead of four speakers, we've got three, but I'm sure that's fine. We will be looking out for him. Possibly he might be logging in later on, but for now we've got three speakers. So welcome everyone to this event that is co-organized by the European Interagency Security Forum, the Lutheran World Federation, and the ICRC. And we're hoping this evening to look at some of the security implications and challenges that the localization of aid agenda might bring for local and national actors, as they are increasingly called to take on more prominent roles. So before I just briefly touch upon a couple of things, just some admin. By all means, tweet, but please put your phones on silent. Then this event is video recorded. The video will be available on the ICRC website in a couple of days, so those who've missed it can watch it. And then at the end, there is a reception upstairs in the ICRC cafeteria after this event, and you're all very warmly welcome to join us. So the role of local actors. Now, there's nothing new. They have been at the forefront of the humanitarian response for decades in many contexts. But the recognition of their importance has only recently kind of come to the fore, not least through the World Humanitarian Summit and the Grand Bargain, which, as you know, has a localization stream, which is chaired by the Federation and Switzerland. And the ICRC is a signatory as well. And it is through this process that the signatories are trying to support local organizations also in their security management. Now, safety and security for the ICRC, not just for our own staff, but also for those organizations we work with on the ground, national societies and others, is something that we deal with on an everyday basis. So we take it very seriously. And it is with that in mind that over the past 15 years, we've developed what we call the Safer Access Framework together with the Federation and national societies. And it is a framework that is basically catering for national societies, bringing in some of the elements of humanitarian principles, looking, for example, at the importance of acceptance by communities, states, non-state armed actors, so local organizations, national societies can in fact safely provide the humanitarian aid that is so sorely needed. So we're hoping this evening that we will have some examples of good practices, but also we'd like to have a discussion also with you here in the room about the challenges of security management in high-risk areas. And I'm delighted to introduce the speakers. Let me start with Lisa Riley, who's the Executive Director of the European Interagency Security Forum. Then online, we've got Oscar Zuluaga, who's the National Director for Cooperation, Innovation. I should put my glasses on. Age is catching up with me. Project Management and Resource Mobilization at the Columbia Red Cross Society. And to my right is Jacob Longar, who's the Senior Support and Liaison Officer and Safety and Security Focal Point at the Lutheran World Federation. And without further ado, I'd like to give the floor to Lisa, who will set the scene. And then we'll continue with the speakers. Before long, we will go to you, and hopefully we'll have some questions, and so we can have a discussion with you all here in the room. Lisa, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Eva. Good evening, and thank you to ICRC for hosting this event this evening. So security risk management is generally an idea that's been around in the humanitarian sector for about the last 15 to 20 years and been slowly gaining momentum in the discussion, though it's often still seen as an inhibitor of programs rather than an enabler. and still many international organisations have not really mainstreamed effective security risk management across their organisations. So within this, it's hardly surprising, really, that security risk management has also not made it onto the agenda of many of the local organisations that we work with. I'm sure, as many of you are aware, in 2015, Steve Dennis successfully sued NRC for gross negligence following his abduction from Dadaab camp in Kenya in 2012. The case really brought to the forefront the need for NGOs to comply with legal duty of care requirements, something which many organisations before then didn't think applied to civil society. And a lot of work has been done since then. It has mainly been around international staff. There has been recognition that we also owe a duty of care to our national staff. But what about duty of care for local partners? Although it's debatable whether we have any legal responsibilities of duty of care for our local partner organisations, we probably have ethical obligations. I mean, if we're transferring risk to them, should we not also be transferring the capacity to manage that risk as well? And finally, just before I leave the topic of duty of care, we can't really go without mentioning the current work that's being done on safeguarding and accountability. Recently, Thomson Reuters have published the results of their annual poll on the most dangerous countries for women. And seven of those top 10 countries identified, we currently have large humanitarian response programs going on. So we need to think about that as well when we're looking at security risk management. Originally, when we used to talk about transferring risk within the NGO sector, it was seen as a security management strategy for international organisations. It's too dangerous for us to work here, we'll just send a local partner organisation. And hopefully that's no longer the main reason we work with local organisations, particularly if we consider the localisation agenda. But however, we do transfer risk. And I think organisations often forget that, because it's not only that we're transferring risk to them, but they're also transferring risk to us as well. For example, what are the perceptions of who we are, who our partners are? Why is the local organisation working with us? What's our political agenda? What's theirs? All of these things can have an impact on the perception of who we are as an organisation, our reputation, and therefore the security. And that's for both partner organisations. We used to assume within the NGO community that we automatically had acceptance with the people we worked and the countries we worked in. As a security strategy, I have heard various people say things along the lines of, but we do lovely things, why would anybody hurt us? Now, this isn't actually an effective security risk management strategy. Unfortunately, most people now accept that this is no longer the case in most contexts that we work in. However, it's equally erroneous to assume that because an organisation is local, it has the capacity, both in time and money, to manage the security risks it faces. And particularly when these risks are impacted by being by a partnership agreement. And this is something we hear a lot of is, oh, they're local, it's fine, they understand. And we're not really giving them the opportunity to unpack that properly. As I say, we often transfer risks, and often it's in ways that we didn't anticipate. There's much discussion in the international humanitarian sphere at the moment around the ideas of neutrality, impartiality and independence, concepts that we all know well. But there are questions asked. Are they still viable? What are we willing to sacrifice to achieve access? Are we taking money from new donors who may not believe in the humanitarian principles? And are we considering what impact that might have on security if we are moving away from the application of the humanitarian principles? And many locals cannot or do not distinguish between who the organisation is, who the NGO is, the governments that fund the organisations, but also the governments that are perceived to fund the organisations. So we may think that we continue to be impartial and independent, but is that how other people see us? And it's very easy for that risk of supporting a Western agenda to be transferred from us as an international organisation to a local organisation. But we also have to consider how risks can be transferred in the other direction as well. In a number of conflict contexts, we have some local organisations who are formed specifically to support a particular section of the community. And their mission and mandate is clearly in support of one side of the conflict or the other. So if we use an organisation to implement our programmes who has this particular perspective, are we still complying with humanitarian principles? And what does this mean in a world of global communications where almost every village has some form of technology and connection to the internet? So the association of an NGO with a particular faction in one country can have an impact on our security on the other side of the world. And we need to make sure that our security risk management strategies for both sides of a partnership agreement take this into account, as there can easily be threats to our staff, to our reputation and our ability to actually implement programmes. A number of international organisations have recognised the need for capacity building of their local partners, but many, unfortunately, still don't really know how to go about doing this. That's also true of EISF. In 2012, we wrote a paper on capacity building for local partner organisations, but it was very much written from the international perspective. We are hoping to start a research shortly about risk management, security risk management, from the partner's perspective, and we're hoping that's going to be funded by UKAID. So one example of well-intentioned support I've seen from an NGO, they provided a one-day training to help their local partner to develop the security risk register for that particular organisation. Unfortunately, they provided no background, no support to integrate the register into the overall management of the organisation, nor was there any opportunity to actually discuss what it meant to them, what sort of framework was most appropriate, and what sort of mitigation measures would actually work for the organisation and the areas that it was working. And although this did provide some immediate understanding of steps they could take to improve the safety of the staff, there was no sustainability to it, there was no replicability, and it certainly made no long-term difference to the resilience of that particular organisation. Obviously, not all NGOs are the same and take the same approach, so there are some good practices around. We've seen from the ACT Alliance, Caritas, as well as others, some really good examples of how they've been working in their networks to build the capacity of local organisations. And this is an approach that normally starts with helping the organisation to understand its own security risk management needs and priorities. It takes a view of it starts with governance and accountability, and what does the organisation actually need. And it looks at what is already being done. We don't need to wipe the slate clean and introduce something new, but how do we build on what's already there? And how do we recognise or help the organisation recognise where they still feel vulnerable and where they still want support? And then we can really help them identify risk management and mitigation measures which are appropriate and effective for them. So in summary, as with international organisations, security risk management is not about making organisations risk-averse and unable to work in the high-risk environments. And it's not a tick-box exercise, but it's really about giving local organisations the tools to understand and manage the risks they face. And also to enable them to be transparent about these risks without the fear that donors or partner organisations will actually stop funding them if they admit that they have difficulties meeting the working with the communities that they wish to. All organisations should be able to design an appropriate and effective security risk management system that keeps their staff as safe as is reasonably possible when they're implementing programmes. Again, it's not locking people into a compound. It's being open and transparent and understanding the risks. And particularly, we need to empower local organisations to be able to recognise and identify the resources they need to be able to build their capacity and actually be able to bring out the solutions that they need in order to continue to reach some of the most vulnerable communities in the world. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa, for setting the scene, touching upon some of the critical issues and assumptions, perhaps, such as having the assumption that one is accepted. We need to question that. To what degree local organizations are safer or not than international ones? What is capacity building? But also the interconnectedness of the world. So technology also plays a role in security risk management. Thank you. I'd like to give the floor now to Oscar and ask ask you to elaborate or share with us some of the challenges that you have as the Colombian Red Cross in gaining negotiating okay. access on the ground. Did you hear my question, Oscar?
Okay. Thank you, Eva. Okay. Yeah, perfectly.
Excellent.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for the invitation. Thank you to the participants. And I'm very glad to share our experience. I would like to say that we started 40 years ago in 78 when we have a seminar about the fundamental principles and respect for the emblem organized for the Americas by ICRC. And at that time, we realized that we need to pass a good message to the communities, to the people, because Colombia is very rich. We have disasters, we have a conflict, we have the loss of the drugs. That means security is a real issue. And we need to pay attention to that. And little by little, we started to create a policy and a permanent plan in order to train the people, in order to give a clear image, the uniforms, the use of the emblem to all our volunteers. We have to think that Colombian Red Cross has branches all over the country. We have more than 28,000 volunteers. We have something like 2,000 staff. But what we decided is to have a clear direction. When ICRC established a regional delegation in 1986, we shared the ideas. And since that, we worked together in order to maintain a clear plan. We evaluated every day the situation because we have a conflict, still we have a conflict, even if we have a peace process. We have a lot of criminality, we have bandits all over the country. It's a huge country, Colombia is 1.2 million kilometers square with mountains, with the Amazonic jungle. We have a lot of disasters, floods, earthquakes. We have bad roads, and in plus, well, we have this conflict and the influence of the people, the criminal bands, the guerrilla, and so on. I think it's important to mention the context because nowadays, after 40 years working together, developing in the recent years the Safer Access program together with the ICRC, we created a system. If you are going to travel, even if you are going to travel to a big city, you have to inform the central coordination system. You have to call when you are start your travel. You have to call when you arrive. But this is a regular procedure. And every day, if we have a problem in one place, we have to communicate it to the central system in order to to record and to analyze the situation. It doesn't matter if it's a disaster, if it's a conflict, if it's an attack. As a result of that, during the, let's say, during the last 25 years, we only have an incident where we have a landslide, and it was not possible to do anything. And some volunteers, they died, because when they were passing in a car, the landslide came, and then they died. And also, we had one volunteer who was killed by accident, because it was a conflict in a neighborhood, and it was just an accident. But that means, due to the clear orientation, we reduce the risk, and now we are working with the communities and with other local actors. We offer to train them. We explain why we use the uniforms, why we use the procedures, why we put the flag in the vehicles, why we have a communication and coordination. And in many cases, we have to stop activities because, according to the analysis, it's danger, or maybe we have a, let's say, for example, recently we have a problem with the dam. We have to analyze if the dam is broken and then a lot of water is coming. Okay, what to do and how to do it. And then we teach the communities, we teach other organizations what to do, how to evacuate it. That means for us, it's a regular procedure. We use all the tools of the Safer Access developed by ICRC. We use the tools developed by the Federation Stay Safe, including the online courses. And let's say that for us, we are very satisfied that the results is our people is not affected by any other problem. I stop here because I know that we have to share other ideas. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Oscar. I was wondering if I could ask a follow-up question. You said that the analysis is critical, that you sometimes, based on that analysis, you stop an activity. So I'm wondering where that analysis is happening. Obviously, on the spot. But then is that then after action, you know, is that analyzed later on after the incident on a more central level? How does information flow from the field where the incident happened and, you know, at a more central level? How does that work?
Okay, it's compulsory. It's an obligation that from the branches, from the local Red Cross, they have to communicate it. Whatever they discover, and they communicate it to the central operations, and then together with ICRC, we do an evaluation, because ICRC has also their system to collect information. And if we receive some information, we share with ICRC and we discuss what to do or not to do it. If ICRC, they receive any other things, they advise, they immediately call Colombian Red Cross, and then we work together. The information flows, and we know that security issues are a priority. Every day we have this. We have one or two in the morning or in the evening. What happened? If we have a problem, if it's not, it's okay. But the coordination flows and the communication.
Thank you very much. Oscar spoke about the context, Jacob, the mix between criminality, conflict, but you also have natural disasters. I'm wondering whether you would like to share some of your experience from Jonglei with us.
Thank you very much, the audience, moderator, and my colleagues. Yeah, Oscar has said, in a similar case in South Sudan, we are more or less the same, but ours is a little bit different in term because it's complex. And the conflict in South Sudan has been a long-term conflict in the country. As some of you might be aware, there was war before the North and the South, The souls got independent, and souls now fight themselves alone. That become a problem of localization today. So for us in Jonglei, Jonglei is not exceptional from other states. They suffer the same, but Jonglei, I will be basing most of my thing in Jonglei because it's where I base, but you have to take it as a sample to the other state. So the current challenges that our local actors are facing in the field, you know, when there is no rule of law, things don't go orderly. There are always cases of arrest. You are arrested when you go to the field, and it becomes a big issue. In the area where no communication network, people disappeared, they have to be looked for, and these are the big issues. There are intimidations, cases of intimidation. You can be stopped asking irrelevant questions. That also become a big, another big issues. Restriction in access to the places of work. In restriction, there are also challenges of sexual violence, kidnapping of the staff, and then abduction at the same time. And these are as a result of no rule of law in the area. In the same time, there are unpredictability of environmental factors. You look at health situation, water, hygiene, and sanitation, which also increase level of diseases. And these are challenges. Having saying that, you also look at the psychological aspect. The same staff who are interested to do activity, they are interested to see the most vulnerable in at the hard-reach areas. Because Jonglei is more of remote. For some of you who have been to South Sudan, it's a big state, which is very remote. So when the staff are affected by the high level of stress, it becomes psychologically you are deceived. Intended to serve your people, you want to be safe, and at the end of the day, things does not go as it is. So all these challenges are all going around because there are so many armed factions in the country. And these are the problems we are facing today in South Sudan. LWF, as an organization who has been there in Jonglei for a period of time, reaching to 20 years as we speak today, is surviving simply because it has built a strong relationship with local communities, religious leaders, so that before you go to the field, you have to have a situation in hand. How did people wake up? How is the community today? And also our local partners who are also, some of them are funded by Alkaline members, and we work with them. So as Oscar said, in South Sudan, we don't have issues like landslide, but gun is become a big problem. A child in the womb is facing the same problem, can be abducted with the mother, and all the issues. So these are the challenges we have. And when we come into localizations and safety, these are the issues.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Those are big challenges. I could just ask a follow-up question. You spoke about the importance of reaching out to communities and to ensure that they know what you're doing. Presumably, that needs to happen on a very regular basis, all the time. Those relationships need to be nurtured. They need to be kept up. How do you do that in LWF?
LWF, as I said, has been in the area for long, so they have capacity built. We have volunteers who have been there, and they are part of LWF, but they are community-based. These are our strong members who give us scenario, how the situation is going. We also have Peace Committee members. We train Peace Committee, and they are community existing. These are people who are locally rooted. They know tension that we have not seen. Then they can provide us. Ours is to analyze, because security is always sensitive. Issues of security, you cannot fix it, and I share with you immediately. Mm. We have to maintain high level of confidentiality, and we see. At the same time, we have our measures in place. They are policies of the organization. When to go out and when not to go. When to come back to the office and when to do which activity. So I've been getting information from our local people in the villages and religious leaders. They are our powerful, our right-hand people who are trusted, because security is all about trust. Your issues are shared with someone who trusts you. But if you are not trust and you go and say, you know, I heard from Lisa that there was something here, mm-hmm. then the security, local security will come and take her, where did you get the information? Mm-hmm. So for us as LWF, we are basing our staying in the area on the trusted members that I have mentioned. The church committee who are having church leaders and church administrators, the Peace Committee, the incentive workers who are volunteer in the community. These are the people that we work with daily. Mm-hmm. And we also train them. We train them, they know element of confidentiality, and we train them as an organization. We have our principle that you cannot breach. Mm-hmm. So they are our part, they are our eyes, they are our ears. And these are how we were surviving. Mm, thank you.
Thank you. We will try to get Jawad. Jawad, can you hear us? Obviously not. Okay, well, we'll try maybe later on. Lisa, I was wondering whether you would want to pick up on a couple of these issues that were mentioned by Oscar and Jacob, whether they, you know, resonate with your experience.
Yeah, I think there was a couple of interesting points. And first of all, from Oscar, it's interesting that we often, within the NGO community, South America, Latin America, doesn't get sort of high on our agenda for security concerns because it's not a conflict environment. So I apologise for that. but it's very true. It doesn't get the emphasis that it should have. And I think Oscar explained very clearly why it is something in an area that we should be prioritising. And then a couple of things that Jacob mentioned. And I think this is where we start seeing the discrepancies, not necessarily even between international organisations and national organisations, but international and local staff of an organisation. He talked about the issue for national staff around disappearance and detention when there's no communication network. Now, if there was no communication network and it was an international member of staff, they would generally be given a sat phone, so that there's a discrepancy. And again, when we're working with donors, they need to understand as well that these costs are something that we need to incorporate. Obviously, there are some environments where carrying a sat phone might actually raise the risk because of what might be seen connected with it. And the other area I thought was really around the psychological aspect that you mentioned. And this is something that, again, has been gaining momentum over the last few years. But few organisations are, again, tackling it from a national perspective. There's a helpline available where people can speak English, maybe French. Mm-hmm. And the way that we deal with psychological issues in the West may not be appropriate in the countries that we're working in. And I think that's another area where we're seeing a discrepancy between how we support international, national and our local partner organisations.
Great, thank you. Maybe Oscar, coming back on that issue of psychological or psychosocial support to volunteers and those working on the front lines, could you maybe share some experience with us? Can you hear me?
Yeah, I didn't hear your question.
Lisa picked up on the issue that Jacob mentioned on psychological effects of volunteers or of those working on the front lines. And I was wondering whether, in your experience, what the Colombian Red Cross does in terms of psychosocial support for its own volunteers.
Yes. Last night I arrived from the south of Colombia. I was in Tumaco. Tumaco is a small city, 100,000 inhabitants, in the border with Ecuador, and it's in front of the Pacific Ocean. And in this part, we are developing different actions. And for example, psychosocial support. We created school brigades in some secondary schools in order to teach them how to deal with the bullying, with the internal conflicts in the schools, questions about sexuality, because sexual violence is recurrent. A lot of people, they have guns outside in the neighborhood. And we tried with the psychosocial support to explain them what to do, how to resist, how to create the dialogue. And yesterday, it was very interesting. We have about 12 young boys and girls, which explaining, it was very interesting for me to hear how they know now how to deal with this, how they reduce the tensions, how they convince the people to not fight, because people live in a lot of stress. This is those are communities affected by a lot of stress, a lot of violence, urban violence, sexual violence. From time to time in the neighborhood, they kill people. In the past weekend, they killed 9 people. And all the people are very affected. But now they are more resilient, even for the sexual violence. It was interesting for me to see a little girl, maybe 12 or 13 years old, explaining what is the sexuality, how they understand it, how they explain to the other colleagues in the school, and how they realize that they have to preserve their life, the respect. And that was very interesting. And this is promoted as a psychosocial support program in that community. In the school.
It's okay, you broke off for a second. Sorry, go ahead, go ahead.
This is interesting because they reduce the problems in the school, in the secondary school, but they say that they wanted to do something in their neighborhood. Because a lot of things, their parents, they are affected by the violence, physical violence, oral violence. They discuss a lot sexual violence, or even the people with the guns, they menace the people, and they don't know what to do it. And then we visited another community with women who has different children, and now they have a livelihood program. They created a kind of association in order to produce food from from shrimps in the manglers. And it is interesting that now they are organized and they are very affected. They suffer physical violence, for example, from their male partners. Sometimes they are beaten, the children also. But now, because they have a job, they have this association. Sorry, can you hear me?
We can hear you, we can't see you.
Okay, something happened. But now this, it was something like 25 women between 20 to 45 years. And it was very interesting to see how now they are very well organized. And now they are starting to do some business. And now they are empowered. And in some cases, they were prosecuted by the criminals or by the guerrilla. They were displaced. But now, because they have an association with the help of the Red Cross, now they are doing much better. And they feel more confident. And also, they talk with the Red Cross things that they do not talk with other people. They do not have a confidence on the police or in other people. They prefer to talk with the Red Cross, to ask for advice. And for us, it was really very interesting to see that. In another neighborhood, we are now reducing the tensions and the violence because it's a palafit. It's a place which is became flooded every day because of the ocean waves. And now we are putting a system of water and sanitation together with the Norwegian Red Cross. And that reduced the tensions and the urban violence. As Jacob mentioned, when you are in a community, you have a lot of tensions. They mentioned also that they have invisible borders. For example, they could not go to some other neighborhoods or other quarters because they are not allowed. These two quarters, they are fighting. And it's interesting how they say that we could not cross, for example, after the football camp to the other neighborhood because it's not safe. In this case, we try to see the factors and to help people to understand and sometimes to negotiate it, but exists a lot of violence. It's not a conflict like in South Sudan, but it's a real conflict. And nowadays, the military people is everywhere in this small village and a small city. And for me, it was very interesting, but life continues. And finally, I wanted to say that one of the difficulties we have, one of the challenges, is that many of the volunteers or the people which is working with us, because of the dangerous situation, they emigrated. And every year we have to restart to recruit new volunteers, to have a dialogue with the same communities because the people change. Some people come, some other emigrate because of the violence. And well, it's a permanent process. And this is a real challenge for us.
Thank you. That's an important point to say that it never ends. Security management is a continuous process. Jacob, if you would to say what needs to be improved, you know, what are the improvements that need to happen in order to have a better security management for local organizations or local actors? What would you say would these be?
I think the important things that we, you know, the context in that particular country also can dictate the approach that can be given. For example, if you train community to be resilient to issues of security, what I mean, when staff are knowing their safety, is also as well giving them chance to assist the community in their wanted way. So one thing to the staff, they need to be given clear guideline. There should be clear guideline from the organization to respect the black time. We can call them black time. For example, if you go to work from 9 in the morning to the field, there are times everybody is going free, but there are red time you cannot go. So all staff has to know the red time must be respected. For example, if I go to Duke, Duk is one of the counties in Jonglei. And I start my journey at 3:30 in Duk, coming to Twiji East at this time of rainy season. They are likelihood I will sleep in the bush because the road is no road. What we call road there is no road, but when the car is passing, we call it road. So in such situation, it is an obligation of the organization in the duty of care to let staff understand that you can give services when you are alive. There are no services when you are not there. And by doing so, you have to go to the field from 9, and then by 1 p.m., you in a far distance, you have to start traveling back to the office. If we give more education on that to our staff, to the existing staff and to those we will recruit as a policy. And anyone who will go beyond that, the organization also has to apply, because every policy has to have a condition. If I jump over the table, this is not what is required in the room. I'm supposed to go this way, not jump over the table. So there must be clear guideline to be given and standardized. If I come to ICRC, these are the same policies, security policies, that are in LWF. If I go to DCA, for example, it is the same policies. By doing that, we would have localized, and the safety of our staff will be there. We are all in danger. Whether international or national staff, they are all in danger. In South Sudan, for example, there are nationalities who are not wanted in a certain location. If you are a Dinka, you may not go to Nuer area. If you are Ugandan, you may not go to Nuer area. If you are Kenyan recently, you may not go to that area. The same thing with white. The other white who are not wanted in this side and maybe on the other side. So we have to analyze. And then also we educate people generally. So security must be for all of us. Whether you are national or international, we have to take care of the security, and it should be put as a policy in the organization. This is what I can say. This is one of the things. At the community level, we must work with those we trust. Otherwise, we will be dragged away from neutrality, impartiality, and then we will become in the middle. And they will say, Jacob of LWF was going yesterday with the rebel commander. He was going with the commander of the army in the army of South Sudan. By that, I'm no longer LWF anymore. I've taken side. So we must make sure security issues must be handled with people we are trusting. It should not be something that you share on the way. It should not be something when you go to the local government, you start with security, what can I do? Or this is what LWF is doing. By getting what you do, they will use against you. They normally say the axe you use to cut the tree, somebody will come and chop the wood with it. So we must use our security with high level of confidentiality, with high level of managerials, who is to communicate security issues. It's not everybody in the management. There should be a last person to communicate issues of the security. There should be a last person at the grassroots to report issues of the security. By doing so, we will have safety and security in place. This is what I can say.
Thank you. One of the things that you just mentioned, when there are different organizations in the same area, if they have the same security rules, that helps. But one of the things that I always find is sharing information on security is an issue. Because of that confidentiality, where do you draw the line? What do you share? What do you, perhaps for good or bad reasons, keep for yourself in an organization? Lisa, how do organizations deal with that issue?
My honest answer is tempted to be badly, but I won't say that. I think it's changing. And I think there's a growing number of networks, such as EISF at the global level, but also such as INSO, or the South Sudan Coordination Forum, which is developing that level of trust, which is enabling information to be shared. And there's a growing recognition where we've had a tendency of organisations to, rather than start from a point of we should share everything, what is it that we can't share, we tend to look at it the other way around and say everything is private, what can we share? And I think we need to sort of have a bit of shift in information, because a lot of time we're not sharing information which doesn't need to be private. And some good examples of where nature abhors a vacuum. If there's no information, all there will be was gossip, and rumours will fill the gap. And then it's much more difficult for people to analyse and actually make those good decisions that both Jacob and Oscar were talking about. Mm-hmm. And we also see it. There's the Saving Lives Together programme with the UN and other coordination mechanisms, which are targeted very much at INGOs. And then you'll often see different coordination mechanisms for the local organisations. And that's, again, another area where we do need to improve sharing of information across those lines.
Thank you. Oscar, if I could ask you, what would you identify as the areas that need improvement in terms of security management?
Well, I think in security and management, we need to improve, of course, coordination and communication. We need to do a permanent training with exercises in order to keep the people, and also because the people change. I think this is something we need to do. We need to listen a lot. And sometimes, because of the confidentiality, you just mention, listen. It is dangerous to go these days to any place. But please, I could not tell you exactly, because what the people told me is because they trust the Red Cross. And we need to create, as Jacob said, this trust, this confidence with the other organizations. And they really, when you pass a message, you don't breach the confidentiality, but you try to advise people to follow some rules or to not go to these places. And I think we can use the technology. Nowadays, we have a lot of technology, even geolocalization, to have maps. I'm not talking only about criminality or guerrilla or conflict, but you can use this to identify the possibility to floods or landslides or fires, or even when you have an earthquake, to localize the situation, and also to see this, how to escape using the best roads if they exist. I think technology is something we need to use it more and in a practical way. We have some open street maps which are available, and available for ICRC, Federation, Red Cross, and many international organizations. Because sometimes if we go to ask for official maps in a country like Jacob explained it, or even in Colombia, in the areas where the guerrilla exists, the government, they do not provide you the maps, but you can use other tools. I think this is the question. Communication, coordination, trust. You need a permanent dialogue with all the actors and all the organizations. You need to train and retrain people. You need to use technology. I think this is, and for me, it's also a question to do programs which do not harm. Because if somebody thinks that you have a favorite people and you neglected others, you need to be very careful. And again, is I think is to listen, to watch, to communicate it, and to maintain the trust. And in many cases, and with this, I finish this part. For example, with the actors of the conflict, or with different people, if you explain well, and you explain that you are an humanitarian organization, people give you access or protect you. And this is very important.
Thank you very much. One of the things that Oscar mentioned, Jacob, was the staff turnover, that you need to continuously train, that once you've trained people and they leave. Do you face the same problem in Jonglei?
Yeah, I agree with Oscar in the sense that staff turnover is common, like the situation I have just mentioned. For example, those who are psychologically, the stress is, you know, when you cope positively with stress, you can continue. But when you cope negatively, others will leave. Whether there is job ahead or no job, you have to leave. So that is one scenario. The other scenario, we are humanitarian. LWF is one of the international NGO and is implementing agency at the same time. So we can have another funding. One is we got another funding, we must have another staff, even if the existing staff are there. So the new coming staff has to be trained. So what I can elaborate more on what Oscar has said, the time of training, the content of training has to be somehow a bit, you know, should be a training based on the area, internationally recognized, but areas of Pacific, like in South Sudan, there should be something to be included that may not be trained in Colombia, for example. So when we see at the methodology and the content of the training, we have to look it into it critically. But training, as ARC ally, we have been having a lot of training. Especially me, I got training twice, three times. But others in the field, I train. Mm-hmm. But there is a need to have more training. And then we retrain and we train to the level also. We give refresher training to the volunteers. The volunteers, because volunteers, we have trained them on our code of conduct. They know very well. They know how to handle themselves. We can also train them, basic training, on how, what kind of information you can give at what time. Mm-hmm. What is a critical time that you can share security-related issue, and what are time that the sharing of information related to security can put you in danger. So these are the training that we need to look. So when we put at the content, we have to see incidences of security. At what time will you report security incident, and what is the nature of the incident you are reporting, and to who? Those things need training. Because I can put LWF chat, other one can put, anybody from the community can get security guard and will say, yes, I'm running, you know, raiders are coming, and they have started attacking the place there. So please tell your people. The security guard will run there. If you have not trained the security guard, for example, will go and give different message. You will start running, you go into your cars, you are running away, there is danger. At the end, maybe there were no raiders. So those are the issues that we need to look into it. By giving training based on the context, on different stages, we must have a safety and security of our staff. And it will be very easy for us to implement, you know, when we are safe. It was mentioned earlier what happened to the NRC staff in Dadaab in Kenya. It is still ongoing. But do we want to be in the same shoes? No, the answer is no. But we have to see how can we make ourselves to understand implementing projects, you must be alive. This is what I can say.
Thank you. On the issue of training that Jacob mentioned, Lisa, the training And you mentioned capacity building as well, a term that is often used and misused perhaps. Has that improved? I remember when I started, training was in a way very generic, but both Oscar and Jacob speak about the need to have specific training based on the context. Is that improving? Is there specific training adapted in the same way that Jacob and Oscar are arguing for?
Yes and no. Some organisations are better than others. I think there is a... there's certainly a growing understanding of how important the context is. And although we still see it where there's a sort of a cut and paste, so we did this in Haiti, therefore it must be okay in Pakistan, there is a recognition of how context-specific the training needs to be. However, I think going back to the point that I was making, which is we can do as much training as we like of individuals on sort of a one-to-one basis if we don't actually change the culture of the organisation so that this is repeated and it's embedded, you're not going to have a long-term change. And I think this is the concern with the high staff turnover. It's very easy for an organisation to actually lose what it's gained in terms of security management if it's not just training of the people at the volunteers and the people at field level, but it has to go all the way to the top of the organisation where governance and accountability has to sit.
Great, thank you. I think we're going to give it another try with Jawad. Jawad, can you hear us? No. Yes? All right. Sorry about that. Oh, what a pity. We would have had the perspective from Pakistan, but unfortunately, technology is not with us tonight. I'd like to open the floor now to the audience for questions, comments. There's a microphone going around, or two microphones. If you would please state your name and affiliation and direct a question to a specific speaker or to all of them. We take 2 to 3 questions at a time. Yes, the gentleman there. And then the back.
Good afternoon. Alan, LWF. First, thank you so much for the presentation. Really good insights, and you know, I think we have a very good panel because it represents different aspects of the security risk management platform. My question is more on, because we're talking about going local and how we're transferring risk to local agencies. And I fully agree with the fact that the security policies that we have at the country level should not just apply to international staff, but also to local staff. But we have to be careful in sort of like making sure that we don't do a band-aid sort of approach, because it has to be contextualized. We were, like 8 years ago when I was in Pakistan, we had this security policy only for expats, and then we said, okay, we need to also give it to the local staff. So we said, okay, we had this big meeting and said, okay, we these are the security policies, these are the things that you shouldn't do. These are the list of places that you cannot go. And some of the local staff, but I live there. so what do I do? So I think we can't just do that, but at the same time, how specific can you be when it comes to your protocols for local staff? And how much do you leave in terms of trusting them that they know their environment? Because the reason why you give the strict protocols to expats is because most of the time they don't know what the context is. But it's different with local staff. They are aware of what it is. But how much do you trust them, their knowledge of the local situation, and how much you do? On the bigger side of it, how much of our policies should be top-down to our country offices, or from country offices to, let's say, field offices, or from country offices to local NGOs? How much of those policies do we enforce from the top-down, and how much do we actually listen from the bottom-up? Because there's value in both. But I think those are the two main questions, because we're talking about going local, we're talking about risk transfer, but also about understanding what roles we all play in this whole thing. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We take a couple more. Yes, there was in the back, the gentleman.
Thank you. I'm Bonaventure Sokpo. I'm working with CHS Alliance. And I would like to add on what Alan just said. I want to share an experience of local actors, because we talk, the panelists talked about training, and everybody agrees on the need of the training for security, on the security aspect. But there is something that I experienced in DRC, is that local actors, they have their own way to analyze the context. And when we are talking to them as international actors, sometimes we forget that they have a kind of local way, local channels of information that we can use. And they were saying, I will give you an example in Eastern DRC. They have, I was talking with local actors and population, and they were explaining the way they can analyze the context. But this kind of information that they are using is not what we are using as international actors. They were saying, for example, that during the night, they can organize, they can try to identify the movement of the troops by what looking at the movement of the lights, when they are using the torch. They can see that. And in the morning, when they are going to the field to crop, they know where the troop have passed, because they can see the footprint of the boots and everything. But they were frustrated because nobody is taking into account this kind of information. So I'm wondering, when we are talking about training, so we are bringing some information from international actors to the local actors, what are we taking from them? So this is what I will also want to know from your experience, if you have seen something like that. Another example is from Central African Republic. I was doing a mission there, and then I told them, as Mr. Jacob was saying, I said, from my organization, we have a restriction in the time where we can go to the field and come. And one of the drivers said, you know, here, you should drive during the night because it's safe. I said, yeah, this is very strange. I will never do that. And he said, you know, during the night, when the vehicle is passing, the people who are attacking, they don't know if it is a military vehicle or NGO vehicle. They will never attack during the night. But during the day, they can see the vehicle and identify who is coming, and then they can attack. It is, oh, this is something interesting, but how can we use this kind of information that are sometimes contradictory to what we believe, what we are doing?
Thank you. One more question, and then we'll go back to the panelists.
Thank you. Matthias van Hullebus, visiting fellow at the Geneva Academy. I think it's very fascinating how this dichotomy between respect for humanitarian principles and humanitarian access plays out. And I think there's different ways to manage the security risks at the same time, so building trust, capacity building, communication, dialogue. But of course, organizations have also limited resources. If you wish to offer your services to one particular group of civilians which are experiencing due hardship, you will seek the consent of the fighting party, which is concerned, which also controls where those civilians are living. As we are talking at the same time, Oscar mentioned this as well, we have to keep open the dialogue with other actors as well. So does that mean in practice that you also are going to seek the approval or the consent from other fighting groups which may control territory just outside that area where those civilians are living? As we were referring to these invisible borders, right? In order to preserve your humanitarian principles on the one hand, and of course to enjoy protection, right? And your freedom of movement, not only for the sake of assisting the civilians with your limited resources you have, but also to cross through different areas to get your goods to that particular location.
Thank you. Let's stick with these three, and then we do another round. Jacob,
yes.
would you like to answer any one of them, and then we'll go to Oscar, and then Lisa, please.
Yeah. Let me answer let me just start with your experience there, especially the last experience you give in Central Africa, where the driver is having his own time, like night is good because the car will not be known is for the army or for whoever. What I want to say here, these are the issues that we actually need to eliminate when we are giving training. They are very risk. That is actually a very, very, very risk situation. And what we need to understand from local staff, they are always putting themselves in danger. What we call a boiling frog syndrome. You know, they treat situation normal. Every situation is normal. At the end, you fall in detention. You are arrested. At the end, some of them are killed because they take situation normal. But insecurity of going to give services must be treated sensitively. So what I want to say from here, we have to deal with that idea, that thinking in their mind is what we need to tell them. Look, we are humanitarian. Where you are pushing us, killing local at the end of the day, there will be someone to ask in the humanitarian equation. Why was he killed? Why was she killed? That question will come. Then you are in problem. So what we are trying to minimize is to see that organizations are in a safer side when they are implementing. Because staff are using, you know, they are using opportunity of the existing environment, that this place of ours is normal. You can even go to Payuel at night, no problem. And this is a very dangerous situation. So what we need to do in such a situation, they are good for us to listen. But in a professional security management system, we must treat them as they are sensitive issues. In security management, situation which has not been analyzed is not publicized. It is not public, it is not consumed by the public. It is individual thinking, we treat it as a sensitive, it is risk. So local, they are always a risk. This is what I want to tell you. At international and local, the first question you ask, for sure, this is the area also we need to look at it critically. For example, in Jonglei, we have 32 staff. 31 are local. One is international. Now, this one international among 31, is that person safe? If we use that example, if we drive in between Panyagor and Wangulei, you don't know, I just give example, this is around 20 kilometers from area of 20 kilometers at night, that international, that person is not safe. So what we want to see, we must make sure when we are planning the risk, when we are planning security management of the organization, we must also take care of international staff. The difference is this. This one international staff does not go to the field frequently. In a week, maybe he can go at once. So his risk is smaller than the one who go from Monday to Friday to the field. But in terms of security, we have to treat them equally. The other scenario, in terms of security, that may need evacuation, for example. International is only one person. We can manage to evacuate him or her to Juba, for example. But you cannot evacuate 31 staff with their wife, children, and uncles, and whoever. You see the difference. So when we look at internationals, we look at them, they are manageable. Organization can use the minimum resources to rescue such a person. But the international staff must know that you are at risk. Local, they are putting them at risk. themselves at risk. In terms of evacuation, 31 times in South Sudan, the standard number of households is 6 people per household. 31 times is 6, how many people? Plus their uncles. So the only thing that will help such group of people is knowledge. Give them knowledge to protect themselves. Give them knowledge to make sure that the services that they are thinking about are for the community as well for their family, for their safety. Let me give a chance to my brother Oscar, and I will also come in case of anything which need more clarification. Excellent. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you, Oscar. Your thoughts on some of these questions?
Thank you to Jacob for you, my brother. You explained it very well, and I have some comments. First, for us, it doesn't matter if it's an expatriate, if it's a member of the National Board of Colombian Red Cross, if it's a top person in the province or very important, or if it's a professional. Security rules are for everybody. Even if the national president wants to do something, the president asks, what is security? And if the security advisor say, you must not go, chill by. That's simple. This is not for discussion. And I think this is something with the ICRC and the Federation, we are very clear. It doesn't matter. People is the most important asset we have. Without our people, we are nothing. And this is the first thing. The second thing is a train and retrain. Sometimes it's not to organize a train. Sometimes it's to show by the example. If you act, if when you arrive, you say, we have the uniform, we have the identification, we have the flag, the car is well marked, we inform the people. This is every day. The most you use the to in the practice when you do security, this is the best training for the people, and the people follow you. And this is important. Third, can we trust local people? Of course. Of course, we must be non-naive, of course, but we need contacts. I remember some years ago, we were in a region working, and we were the Colombian Red Cross team. We came in the morning, and we were doing something. And then around lunchtime, somebody came to talk with us and said, and it was a sunny day, so beautiful, and said, okay, what you are doing is nice, it's very good, and so on. At what time you are leaving? And we said, no, maybe at 5. And then because it's 1 or 2 hours, it's evening, still we have a daylight and so on. And the person said, you know, the weather is going to change. It's maybe will rain a lot. I advise you to leave at 3. And we know that was a clear message that some problems, they will come, but they don't want it to damage or to hurt the Red Cross people. And then the person said, at what time, when you are coming back? We said, well, next week. They said, you know, the weather will continue badly. Maybe in 3 or 4 weeks. And of course, we are not naive, and we follow the advice. And I remember one of my good friends from ICRC working in a country. All of them, they used to have a breakfast at the office. But he used to go to the popular restaurant where all the drivers from the trucks and the autobuses, they stop. And he went to eat. I am not going to tell you the name and the place. every morning, a good breakfast with eggs and some other things. And then when he arrived at 8 to the ICRC delegation, said, you know, The driver, they told me that in that region is a problem, that in the other region. And it was very interesting because the information was classified, but they traveled the country. And they knew it, that they were talking with the ICRC delegate. Well, not the ICRC, the Red Cross delegate, because they have no idea what is ICRC. But it was very funny because he arrived and said to the head of the delegation, I have news. And this is interesting. Of course, you need some control, you need to verify. But in Colombia, at least, we know that when we receive any comment or advice from people we don't know, it's a clear message. And sometimes that helped us. But I wanted to mention something about security, which we didn't touch here, is the burnout of people. Sometimes when a delegate, international delegate, expatriate, stayed for 6 months or 1 year, is exhausted. But we never think on the local people, local people from the NGOs. They are every day, they live with the people, they live with the problems. They are also exhausted. And many times here, when we have a long-term operations, for example, with the migrants, I raise the flag and I said, we need to take these people out. They have been for 6 months or 8 months. They are exhausted. They are starting to make stupid mistakes because they are tired. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we are not careful with our people. And this is something we need to pay attention, I think, in our organizations at the local level, because we care about the leaders, we care about the expatriates, but we forgot the ordinary people, which is working with us, volunteers, staff, or even some people who usually help our organizations. And I think this is something we need to pay attention.
Thank you.
That's it.
Yeah, thank you very much, Oscar. I think time is running out. Sorry, Lisa, if we take three more questions, brief, please. And then, so here, there, and there. And then other questions will be over a glass of wine. There was a gentleman here, just behind you. Oh, sorry.
It'll be really quick, I promise. I wanted to go back to something that Lisa Riley, you said, where you said communities nowadays don't differentiate between organizations, donor governments, and governments who are perceived to be donating. And that resonates quite a lot because a lot of the work that we do, we see that the way people perceive things actually matters more than the truth. And no matter what reactive press line you put out there, once there's a rumor or a misinformation, you're sort of stuck in this vicious cycle. And my question was, to what extent, I hate what I'm about to say, but like on a meta level, to what extent should organizations accept this sort of post-truth modus operandi where what people think or feel matters more than what you're objectively doing? Or to what extent should it, from a principled point of view, fight back and say, actually, we refuse to let people's opinions and feelings determine our security, and we will continuously push for an objective examination of what we're doing.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Kirsten Hagen from IFRC, and thank you for the presentations. I wanted to ask a question about donor policies and what they're willing to give in terms of funding around these issues. So in terms of the issues that have been raised, I thought it was really interesting Lisa's comment about we are willing to transfer risk, are we willing to also transfer capacity, and this concept of duty of care being really important. And then hearing from Oscar and Jacob, you talked, one, about training. Secondly, I'm hearing a lot that's relevant to human resources and capacity. You clearly have people who are dedicated to doing these systems and procedures, implementing and developing those procedures. The third one was around physical security materials, so cars, radios you mentioned, lights, vests, and so on. The one that wasn't mentioned was insurance, which is something we often hear from national societies and other local actors as being particularly important, and sometimes these organizations cannot get the insurance themselves. And I'm curious to hear if you find it difficult to get the funding that will enable you to do the things you want to do and need to do, that will pay for the insurance, pay for the infrastructure, pay for the staffing and so on.
Thank you. Very, very relevant question. And one more, Susan.
Yes, LWF Susan Mouse. I have a question on, we talked about localization and working with local actors. For example, in certain insecure environments, like Syria, for example, we work with local actors, so we transfer risk to them to be faced daily by certain risks, right? But Lisa, you also were talking about that. And what are the risks local actors actually transfer to international organizations? Can you maybe explore a bit on that?
Thank you. Lisa, do you want to start with this question?
Do we accept the perceptions or do we push back? My answer to that is I think we should always try and work as much as possible for people to understand what it is that we're doing and what our objectives are. But in terms of security, if we only consider what we think we're doing rather than what others think we're doing, we're not going to be protecting ourselves properly. So I think we need to actively work. I think this is something else we don't necessarily do, is try to actively get people to understand what our principles are and what we mean. Right. I remember having this conversation, I think it was in Pakistan. We call ourselves NGOs, non-governmental organisations. If people don't speak English well, the only word they understand is government. So, yes, raise awareness, but two, for good security, we have to work on perceptions. Donor policy for funding? We ask them regularly. It's quite difficult to get a good answer. What they are telling us is that if we can justify the cost, they're more likely to fund it. So if you're doing a log frame and there's a column on the end that says risks, if you put your security risks in that column, you have an opportunity to start actually putting in your mitigation measures and your management measures. Whether the donor will accept them or not is another matter. Where the problem often lies is, one, security people don't know how to do a budget. So if you ask them for costs, they may put in the extra phone or another car. Do they know how much an acceptance strategy costs to implement is something else. Does anybody think about insurance for the local organisations? So that's one side is a problem. The other side is that we often see the proposal writers going, oh, the overheads are too high, the indirect costs are too high, what can we cut out? Oh, security isn't important. So it's often not the donor that's stopping us getting money, it's our own internal structures that are causing the problem. Transfer of risks from local to international, I think it is often around, again, the affiliations of the local organisation. And it is so global these days. I won't mention the organisation, but it was a faith-based organisation. In one country, they really used the faith part of their job title, their organisational title, because it synchronised with the country they were working in. In another country, they used the initials because they didn't want to have the affiliation with the faith. The problem was somebody went to the website and went, hang on a minute, here you're called this, there you're called that, you're lying. So this is one of the issues, is we need to be careful who... sorry, I went a bit far from the local to the international, but it's around those affiliations, what people may see in other places when they see we're linked with certain organisations. And the same between any behaviours of individuals. I think you were saying your LWF, whatever time of day or night, same with the Federation. So it's just recognising that it goes beyond our own, the behaviour of our own staff. It's how our partners are behaving that can also be transferred over to us.
Great. Thank you very much. We'll go in reverse order briefly, Oscar, and then Jacob, and then we'll have to close. Oscar.
Thank you. Regarding insurance, I think it's good to talk about two examples. One is in the Federation of Red Cross Red Crescent, we establish a payment for insurance, which is something like $1.5 or $2 per person, especially for volunteers. And with this, this is of course yearly for 12 months, you have a coverage which in terms of economical help is about $3,000. And I think you invest 1.5 and then you get, if you have a medical problem, accident, or if you have a disabled, or if you die, at least you receive $3,000. I think it's a good solution. And as I know, something like 100 Red Cross, Red Crescent, they use it, this system. Of course, the other national societies, especially Europeans, they have their own insurance. In the and this is important to mention. But in Colombia, we managed to get an agreement with the government for the National Disaster Committee. And now they pay the insurance for civil defense people, firemen, and Red Cross volunteers. And this is very expensive, and they use the insurance company from the government. And what is interesting is, in reality, if you have a problem, an accident, or you die, or whatever, you have something like, in return, something like $40,000 to cover the expenses. And I think, but this is an important decision, because we were discussing with the Colombian government, and finally they accept for the three most important health organizations in Colombia. And I think this is important. Regarding the who pay for vests, uniforms, equipment, communication, and so on, I think this is a long-term effort. But if you include in the projects and programs, you manage. In the case of Colombia, of course, because we are very rich in disasters, crises, and conflicts, during the last 40 years, we invest money to have this. And of course, we ask the donor and explain the situation. And even ICRC, for example, they paid the training in safer access for many, many volunteers and staff every year. And this is the way we negotiated with the donors. And I think this is some ways to find resources and to cover a problem. And I think this is important.
Thank you very much, Oscar. Jacob, last words.
Thank you. The three questions are more or less the same in terms of answering. When we look at the insurance, for example, this is the right forum for discussing such issues. You know, security-related issues, when we, in relation to funding, they were not much more focused on. We look at them like manageable, the way the local look at them in the field. But as time come and they have become now, we are bringing them up, the donors also will listen to the discussion like this. So when you put it in your log frame, when you are, and then you point out some of the risks that you are seeing, donor also, they listen like us. Some of us here in the room may be our donors also. So they are listening. So the issue is how you can convince your donors on the sensitivity of that particular item in the project. If it is absent, what damage will it make to the impact that the project is looking for? So what I want to say from here is that we have to strengthen insurance, and then we have to educate our donors how important it is in relation to localization and safety. In the questions of donor policy, yes, donor They want to know a dollar per hour, for example. So they want to see every dollar is going for what. This is very clear. So it is our roles as humanitarians, responsible people, like in LWF, Alkaline, another organization, to make sure that we advocate for the localization and safety. In order to transfer the risk to the local, we must take care of the insurance. This is what will make you to be thinking safe. International, transferring risk from international to the local, it is a long-term things. To me, when I look at it, this is the beginning. And I appreciate actually the organizers. This is the beginning. Now everybody will listen. This thing, oh, it is a big issue. It is a big issue. So at the end of 5 years, and if we come like this again and we review, we will see the risk has gone slowly, slowly. Because if we transfer the risk today from the international to the local, you will hear after 3 days all the local are finished, you know? They are finished because it is too heavy. It will drop them down. But if we go slowly, slowly by slowly, they have that training which may not need money. Jacob can train security guard, can train drivers. You know, if I have knowledge, I can train them slowly by slowly. And then I am trained. I can be trained to go and train. So what I used to come to Geneva, when I go back, I have to transfer it to the local positively. So from there now, you use 2,000 or 3,000 euro for me, and then I will go and train 100 staff. So this is another way we can transfer risk slowly from international to the local. So we have to improvise. We have to improvise other ways in regard to funding, because funding donor policy is so strict. We know very well. It's so strict. So if we go and we carry it on our head, that yes, localization and safety is a new idea, and we want to make sure that our staff are not going to be in problem, they have their own question. So this is what I want to say. I'm so happy, but I know thing will change slowly by slowly. It is all about attitude. Security, in my final remark, is all about attitude and behaviors. The way you perceive the environment make environment to become difficult to you and make it to become very simple to you. So our local has to know the environment is good and bad. This is a message that we have to know, the local. International, of course, we have to take care of them. The local have to be responsible to take care of international, and international has to plan for local. If we do it vice versa, we will have a very good localization and we will go safely. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Words of wisdom. I'm sorry to cut the discussion short. There was a lot of interest and a couple of questions unanswered, I know. I'd like to thank the panelists, Lisa, Jacob, Oscar, and Jawad. Sorry we didn't manage to get him online. Thank you very much for taking the time out of your busy schedules to join us. And we're hoping that you will join us for a glass of something. I'm sure there are colleagues around to show you around, because it's in the cafeteria, it's up the stairs, but there are colleagues who can guide you. Thank you again. The video will be up, I think, tomorrow or in a couple of days, latest. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.